Other people were less difficult to work with, some of them downright pleasant, in fact. People who little by little began to count as friends. Among them Tom Ginelli, a chunky, balding photographer from the Bronx, who often went out on stories with Ferguson and could imitate the voices of 24 Hollywood actors and actresses to near perfection. His Betty Davis was sublime. And Nancy Sperone, a recent graduate from the University of Rochester, who had landed a spot on the women's page and was going for an advanced degree in after-hours flirting, which helped get him through the early adjustment period without having to sleep alone every night. And Vic Hauser from sports, who was tracking Bobby's progress with the Orioles and responded no less happily than Ferguson did when Bobby went 2-for-4 in his one World Series start against the Mets. And beyond the people he was coming to know and like of the paper, there was the paper itself, the big building and the hundreds of employees who worked there every day, editors and movie critics, receptionists and telephone operators, obituary writers and fishing columnists, reporters typing up stories at their desks, copy boys running around from floor to floor, and the huge on-site printing press down below, cranking out a new paper every morning in time to hit the streets by noon. And despite the grumpy, butchering Dunlap, who had emerged as the second coming of Edward Imhoff, Ferguson enjoyed being part of that complex swarm of bustling bodies and never regretted the decision he had made. No regrets, but even though Nancy Sperone was an unencumbered single woman, which had not been the case with the tempting but off-limits Margaret O'Mara George, Ferguson knew from the start that she was not the answer. Nevertheless, he went on going out with her and sleeping with her during his first 9 months in Rochester, which was the first time in his life he had entered into a less than passionate, off-and-on affair with a woman he was fond of but could never bring himself to love. The native-born Nancy showed him around town by introducing him to one of Rochester's famous Friday night fish fries, dragged him to a joint called Nick Tauhu Hats to indulge in another Rochester dish known as the garbage plate, an experience Ferguson swore he would never repeat for as long as he lived, and sat through several old movies with him at the Eastman House archive, among them Bresson's A Man Escaped and Kazan's 1945 Sabathon, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which induced both of them to shed the requisite oceans of blubbering, nonsensical tears. Nancy was bright and companionable, an earnest reader of books and a talented journalist, who had joined the Times Union as another one of McManus's new wave of kids, a dark-eyed brunette with short hair and a large round face, her little Lulu face, as Nancy called it, a bit on the heavy side, perhaps, but sexy enough to make Ferguson long for her body whenever they were apart for more than a week or 10 days. It wasn't Nancy's fault that he couldn't love her, but neither was it Ferguson's fault that Nancy was looking for a husband and he had no interest in looking for a wife. In mid-December, when he went down to Florida for a short weekend visit with his parents, he understood that he and Nancy were going nowhere, but still he went on seeing her for another 4 months after he returned, muddling along as previously until Nancy found a new man who wanted to marry her, which was a good thing, Ferguson decided, since all through the months of not being able to love Nancy Sperone, there had been the dawning awareness that after one full year and the better part of another year with no Schneiderman in sight, he still hadn't recovered from losing Amy. He was still mourning her absence, as if hanging on in the aftermath of a divorce, perhaps even a death. And there was nothing to be done about it except to keep hanging on until he didn't feel it anymore. Almost a year had gone by since he had last been with his parents, and now that they had fully settled into the alien world of southern Florida, they had turned into creatures of the sun, tanned and healthy-looking ex-northerners living and working in the land of no snow, advocates of long walks on sand-covered patches of earth, his mother, and outdoor tennis every morning from January through December, his father. And yes, Ferguson was glad to see them again, but they had both changed in the gap between visits, and those changes were the first things he noticed when they picked him up at the airport early Friday evening. Not so much his mother, perhaps, who was still rushing around with her photography work at the Herald and liked nothing better than to talk newspaper talk with her son. But she had been trying to quit smoking in the past 6 months and had put on weight, perhaps 10 or 12 pounds, which made her look different somehow, both older and younger at the same time, if such a thing was possible. Whereas his father, who was nearing 56 and still strong because of his daily tennis routine, nevertheless struck Ferguson as slightly diminished, with grayer, more thinned-out hair and a slight limp when he had to walk for more than 50 or 100 yards, a pulled muscle or else permanently aching feet, no longer the numb and silent Dr. Manette toiling away at his workbench, but a clerk in the classifieds department at the Herald, a job he professed to enjoy and even love, but it had turned him into a lowly Bob Cratchit. And Ferguson couldn't help thinking of what a long, slow fall it had been, from Three Brothers' homeworld to this. The best day of the Friday to Sunday visit was the last day, when they went out for a large, unhurried brunch at Wolfie's on Collins Avenue, the good smells of fresh onion rolls and smoked fish flooding the room as the three of them ate lox and eggs in honor of Ferguson's grandmother, whom they talked about at length, along with Ferguson's grandfather and the now vanished Dee Dee Bryant, but mostly his mother asked him questions about Rochester and the Times Union, wanting to know everything about everything. And Ferguson told them nearly everything he could, failing to mention his involvement with Nancy Spurone, because it probably wouldn't have sat well with his father. The mere thought of his boy going around with an Italian Catholic girl no doubt would have upset him, leading to some bitter us-versus-them remarks about Schwarzes and Schickses, words that Ferguson hated, two of the ugliest words in the Yiddish lexicon. And so he left Nancy out of it and talked about McManus and Dunlap instead, about Bobby George hitting his first big league home run in Boston last July, and now just 4 months away from becoming a father, about some of the articles he had written and the tawdry beaten-up apartment where he lived, which led his mother to ask the question all mothers ask their children, whether those children are small, piss-in-the-pants tykes, or 22-year-old college graduates. "Are you okay, Archie?" "I sometimes wonder what I'm doing there," Ferguson said, "but I think I'm all right, still feeling my way for now. More or less okay, more or less happy with the job. But one thing is clear, one thing you can be absolutely certain about. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in Rochester, New York." Three alarm fires, the 20th anniversary of an unsolved murder case, anti-war activity at the local colleges and universities, the breakup of a ring of dog snatchers, a fatal traffic accident on Park Avenue, the establishment of a new tenant association in the black neighborhoods on the west side of town. For 5 months, Ferguson toiled as a lowly cub reporter under the suspicious gaze of Joe Dunlap, and then McManus pulled him off the city beat and handed him something big. Apparently, Ferguson had passed the test. Not that he had ever known the precise nature of the test or by what standards McManus had been judging him, but however it had happened, one could only conclude that the boss now felt he had graduated to the next level. On the morning after Christmas, McManus summoned Ferguson to his office and told him about a thought that had been turning around in his mind lately. "The 60s were just about done," he said. "There was less than a week to go before the big ball dropped. And what did Ferguson think about writing a series of articles on the past 10 years and how they had affected American life? Not a chronological approach, not a timeline summary of major events, but something more substantial than that. A sequence of 2,500-word stories on various pertinent subjects. The war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the growth of the counterculture, developments in art, music, literature, and film, the space program, the contrasting tonalities among the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations, the nightmare assassinations of prominent public figures, racial conflict, and the burning ghettos of American cities, sports, fashion, television, the rise and fall of the new left, the fall and rise of right-wing republicanism and hard-hat anger, the evolution of the Black Power movement, and the revolution of the pill. Everything from politics to rock and roll to changes in the American vernacular. The portrait of a decade so dense with tumult that it had given the country both Malcolm X and George Wallace, The Sound of Music and Jimi Hendrix, the Berrigan brothers and Ronald Reagan. No, it wouldn't be the usual kind of reportage. McManus continued. It would be a look back, a way of reminding Times Union readers where they had been 10 years ago and where they were now. That was one of the advantages of working for an afternoon paper. More leeway, more time to dig around and investigate, more opportunities to run feature-length stories. But it couldn't be just a dry rehash. He wasn't looking for an academic history, but articles with some bite to them. And for every book and back-issue magazine Ferguson read for his research, McManus wanted him to talk to 5 people. If he couldn't get hold of Muhammad Ali, then he should track down his trainer and corner man, Angelo Dundee. And if he couldn't get through to Andy Warhol, then he should call Roy Lichtenstein or Leo Castelli. Primary sources, the ones who did the doing or were close by when something happened. Was he making himself clear? Yes, he was making himself clear. And what did Ferguson think? I'm all for it, Ferguson said, but how many pieces do you want, and how long do I have to write them? About 8 or 10, I would imagine, and roughly 2 weeks to write each one, give or take. Is that enough? If I give up sleeping for a while, I suppose it will be. Do I hand them in to Mr. Dunlap? No, you're finished with Dunlap. You'll be working directly with me on this. And where and how do I begin? Go back to your desk and come up with 15 or 20 ideas, subjects, titles, musings, whatever seems most urgent to you, and then we'll figure out an overall plan. I can't tell you how much this means to me. It's a job for a young person, Archie, and you're the youngest one I have. Let's see what happens. Ferguson put everything he had into the articles because his entire future at the paper depended on them. He wrote and rewrote. He whipped through more than 100 books and close to 1,000 magazines and newspapers. And not only did he talk on the phone to Angelo Dundee, Roy Lichtenstein, and Leo Castelli, but to dozens of other people as well, assembling a chorus of voices to accompany the text he wrote on the good old, bad old days of recently vanished yore. 8 2,500-word stories that covered politics, presidents, and the pandemonium of social dissent, along with excursions into the music of John Berryman's dream songs, the slow-motion massacre at the end of Bonnie and Clyde, and the spectacle of 500,000 American children dancing in the mud one weekend on a farm in New York State, just 250 miles south of Rochester. By and large, McManus was satisfied with the results and edited his work only lightly, which was the most gratifying part of the exercise for Ferguson. But the boss was also pleased that the articles elicited scores of letters from the public, most of them positive, with comments such as, "A big thanks to A.I. Ferguson for leading us on a walk down memory lane," but with a fair share of negative comments as well, attacks on Ferguson's pinko views of our great country. That stung a little, he had to admit, even though he had been expecting worse. What he hadn't been expecting was how much hostility he would feel from some of the young reporters on the staff. But that was how the game worked, he supposed, every man for himself in the scrum to grab the ball. And as Nancy pointed out each time he published another piece, their resentment only proved how well he was doing his job. There were supposed to be 10 articles in the series, but Ferguson had to stop just as he was preparing to tackle the 9th one, on long hair, miniskirts, love beads, and white leather boots, the novelties of mid and late 60s fashion, when another hammer blow was delivered from beyond. The anti-war movement had been relatively quiet in recent months. The gradual withdrawal of American troops, the so-called Vietnamization of the war, and the new draft lottery system had all contributed to the lull in activity. But then, in the final days of April 1970, Nixon and Kissinger abruptly expanded the war by invading Cambodia. American opinion was still divided down the middle, roughly half for and half against, which meant that half the country supported the action, but the other half, the ones who had been marching against the war for the past 5 years, saw this, quote, strategic incursion as the end of all hope. They took to the streets by the hundreds of thousands. Massive demonstrations were organized on college campuses, and on one of those campuses in Ohio, nervous, badly trained young National Guardsmen fired live ammunition at the students, a 3-second fusillade that wound up killing 4 and wounding 9. And so horrified were most Americans by what happened at Kent State that they spontaneously opened their mouths and sent forth a collective howl that spread across the entire land. Early the next morning, May 5th, McManus dispatched Ferguson and his photo partner Tom Ginelli to the University of Buffalo to report on the demonstrations there, and suddenly he was no longer investigating the recent past, but living in the now again. The school had gone through weeks of fractious conflict in late February and early March, but even the more subdued eruption after Kent State was much wilder than anything Ferguson had seen at Columbia, especially on the second day he was there, a wintry Buffalo day in mid-spring, with snow on the ground and ice winds blasting in off Lake Erie. No buildings were occupied, but the atmosphere was more charged and potentially more dangerous, as close to 2,000 students and professors were attacked by helmeted riot police carrying guns, clubs, and tear gas rifles. Rocks were thrown, bricks were thrown, the windows of police cars and university buildings were smashed, heads and bodies were smashed, and once again, Ferguson found himself dead center between two warring mobs. But it was scarier this time because the Buffalo students were more willing to fight than the Columbia students had been. Some of them so incensed and out of control that Ferguson felt they might have been willing to die. Whether he was a journalist or not, he was just as exposed as they were, and much as he had been swept up into it 2 years earlier with the blows to his head and hand, this time he was tear-gassed along with everyone else, and as he pressed a wet handkerchief against his stinging eyes and vomited his lunch onto the pavement, Ginelli took hold of his arm and pulled him away to look for a spot where the air would be more breathable. And a couple of minutes later, when they had come to the corner of Main Street and Minnesota Avenue, just off campus, Ferguson removed the wet handkerchief from his face, opened his eyes, and saw a young man throw a brick through the window of a bank. Within another day or two, three-quarters of the colleges and universities in America were on strike. More than 4 million students joined in the protest, and one by one, every college and university in Rochester shut down for the rest of the academic year. The day after Ferguson filed his Buffalo story, he had a brief talk with McManus at the front entrance of the Times Union building. Staring out at the traffic as they smoked their cigarettes, they both reluctantly acknowledged that there would be no point in publishing any more articles about the 60s. 8 had been enough, and the 9th and 10th were no longer necessary. After Nancy Sperone found her new man in the early days of the student strike, Ferguson squandered the next 6 months pursuing two different women who were not worth the effort of pursuing and shall remain nameless because they are not worth the effort of naming. Ferguson was beginning to grow restless, feeling that perhaps he had had enough of Rochester after a year and a half in that minor league city, wondering if he shouldn't try his luck somewhere else with another paper, or perhaps leave journalism altogether, and try to earn his living as a translator. For however much he still enjoyed the pressures of high-speed composition, wrestling with Villon's 15th-century French was ultimately more satisfying to him. And even though time was scarce, he had polished off a not-bad first rendering of the Legacy and was halfway into a preliminary version of the Testament. Not that he could ever feed himself by translating poetry, of course, but a fat book of prose every now and then might help cover the bills. And if nothing else, even if he did stay in Rochester for a while longer, wouldn't it make sense to leave the crummy, roach-infested dump on Crawford Street and move to a better place? It was January 1971, February 1971, the darkest, coldest days of the year in that glum hibernal outpost, a time when only glum things could be expected to happen, a time of death fantasies and daydreams about living in the tropics. But just as Ferguson was beginning to think he should bury himself under a pile of quilts and remain in bed for the next 3 months, his job at the Times Union became interesting again. The circus was back in town. The lions and tigers were roaring. A crowd was gathering under the tent, and Ferguson hastily jumped back into his tightrope walker's costume and scrambled up the ladder to take a spot on the platform. After the Kent State shootings, he had been assigned to the National Desk and was now working under a man named Alex Pittman, a young editor with good instincts and a more tolerable disposition than Dunlap's. Ferguson had handed in dozens of stories to Pittman over the long weeks between May and February, but nothing as compelling as the two big stories that broke in the first half of the new year, which curiously enough turned out to be two versions of the same story, tying up loose ends from the 50s and 60s because someone had been brave enough to steal classified government documents and release them to the public, which meant that even after the 60s were chronologically over, they weren't over and were in fact just beginning, all over again. On March 8th, an unknown group of invisible activists calling themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into the small two-man government office in the oddly named town of Media, Pennsylvania, and swiped more than 1,000 secret documents. By the next day, those documents had been sent to various news organizations across the country, exposing the FBI's covert spy operation, COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, which had been started by J. Edgar Hoover in 1956 to harass the 14 or 26 communists still left in America, and then had expanded to include members of black civil rights organizations, anti-Vietnam War organizations, black power organizations, feminist organizations, and over 200 organizations from the New Left, among them SDS and the Weathermen. Not just spying on them, but infiltrating their ranks with informants and agents provocateurs to disrupt and discredit them. And just like that, the nuthouse fears of 60s activists were turning out to be true. Big Brother had indeed been watching, and Nobodaddy's craziest, most loyal soldier had been behind it all, squat little J. Edgar Hoover, who had amassed so much power during his 47 years in office that presidents quaked when he knocked on their door. The documents revealed hundreds of crimes and hundreds of low blows to smear the names of innocent people, but none lower than the job he had done on Viola Liozzo, who was the subject of one of Ferguson's articles, the Detroit housewife with five children who had gone down to Alabama for the Selma Montgomery March, and for the simple act of opening her car door and giving a lift to a black man, had been murdered by a group from the Klan, one of the murderers being Gary Thomas Rowe, an acknowledged FBI informant. And then Hoover had had the temerity to write a letter to Johnson telling him that Mrs. Liozzo had been a member of the Communist Party and had abandoned her children in order to have sex with black men from the civil rights movement, a bogus accusation that suggested she had been an enemy of the people and therefore someone who had deserved to die. 3 months after the COINTELPRO scandal, the Pentagon Papers were published in the New York Times, and Ferguson worked on that story as well, including the story behind the story of how Daniel Ellsberg had smuggled the papers out of the building and given them to Times reporter Neil Sheehan, the once abhorred New York Times perhaps atoning for the lies it had printed in 68 by taking the risk of going public with classified documents. A bright moment for American journalism, as Pittman, McManus, and Ferguson all agreed. And suddenly, the lies of the American government were standing naked in front of the entire world. The things that had never been reported anywhere in the press, the secret bombings of Cambodia and Laos, the coastal raids on North Vietnam. But beyond that, and before that, the thousands of pages delineating the step-by-step process by which something that had once seemed to make sense had collapsed into utter senselessness. Then the circus left town again, and Ferguson fell into the arms of Hallie Doyle, a 21-year-old student from Mount Holyoke with a summer job at the paper, the first woman he had met since moving north who might have had the power to break the Amy spell at last, a deeply intelligent and insightful person who had been raised in the Roman Catholic Church but was no longer part of it because she didn't believe that virgins could be mothers or that dead men could climb out of their graves. Yet she lived with an inner certainty that the meek would inherit the earth, that virtue was its own reward, and that not doing unto others what you didn't want them to do unto you was a more sensible way to conduct your life than struggling to follow the precepts of the Golden Rule, which forced human beings to turn themselves into saints and led to nothing but guilt and unending despair. A sane person, perhaps even a wise one, A small but not diminutive person of 5'4 or 5'5, with a lean, quick-moving body, a pair of granny glasses perched on her nose, and intensely yellow hair, so blonde as to create the impression of a fully grown Goldilocks. But attractive as that golden hair was to Ferguson, the mystery was in Hallie's face, which was both a plain face and a pretty face, by turns dull and sparkling, a face that changed aspect with the slightest turn or tilt of her head, now a Goldilocksian mouse, now a stunning White Rock girl, now bland and almost featureless, now radiant and arresting, an unremarkable Irish mug that could, in a single blink, transform itself into the most ravishing countenance ever beheld this side of a movie screen. What was he to make of such a conundrum? Nothing, Ferguson decided, nothing at all, since the only answer was to go on looking at her in order to feel the more and more pleasant sensation of being permanently off balance. She had grown up in Rochester and was back in town for the summer to sell her family's house on East Avenue, which had become redundant after her science writer parents moved to San Francisco earlier in the year. The job at the Times Union had been obtained through the help of an old family friend. It was nothing but a way to kill the time more efficiently than by doing nothing, along with a chance to earn some extra cash into the bargain. A temporary newsroom assistant for the summer, but in her real life a dual English biology major who would be starting her senior year in the fall. A budding poet with a long-range plan to go to medical school, then push on to become a psychiatrist, and finally to train as a psychoanalyst, all of which was impressive enough, but what impressed Ferguson even more was how she had spent the 2 summers before this one, living in New York and answering telephones at a suicide hotline on East 4th Street and Avenue A. In other words, he said to himself, when he had been listening to the record spin out the lurid, demoralizing verses of "Lord, thy name is death," Hallie had been working to save lives. Not everything all at once, as Amy and so many others believed, but one by one by one. Talk to a man on the telephone, and gradually convince him not to pull the trigger of the gun he is pointing at his head. Talk to a woman the next night and slowly persuade her not to down the bottle of pills clenched in her hand. No impulse to reinvent the world from the bottom up. No acts of revolutionary defiance, but a commitment to doing good in the broken world she belonged to. A plan to spend her life helping others, which was not a political act, so much as a religious act, a religion without religion or dogma, a faith in the value of the one and the one and the one, a journey that would begin with medical school and then continue for however long it took to complete her psychoanalytic training. And while Amy and a host of others would have argued that people were sick because society was sick and helping them adjust to a sick society would only make them worse, Hallie would have answered, "Please, go ahead and improve society if you can, but meanwhile people are suffering and I have a job to do." Not only had Ferguson met the next one, but as the summer went on, he asked himself if he hadn't found the one who would blot out all others for the rest of his days on this wretched, beautiful earth. She moved into the Crawford Street rat hole with him in early July, and because it was an especially hot summer that year, they pulled down the window shades and turned into nudists whenever they were indoors. Outdoors, on weekday nights and weekend days and nights, they went to 12 movies together, attended 6 Red Wings games, played tennis 4 times, the ultra-athletic Hallie consistently beat him 2 sets to 1, took walks in Mount Hope Cemetery, sat in Highland Park reading each other's poems and translations, until Hallie broke down in tears one Sunday afternoon and declared that her work was no good. "No, not no good," Ferguson said to her, "still developing," although there seemed little doubt that she had a more promising future in medicine than in literature. Went to 4 classical concerts at the Eastman School of Music, Bach, Mozart, Bach, and Webern, and ate numerous dinners in all manner of restaurants, both decent and atrocious. But no dinner was more memorable than the one they had at Antonio's on Lake Avenue, where the meal was accompanied by nonstop music from a man named Lou Blandisi, who billed himself as the corny accordionist from Little Italy. and seemed to know every song that had ever been written, from American pop standards to Irish jigs to klezmer from the Pale. More to the point, by the first days of August, they had both uttered the decisive three-word sentence several dozen times each, the three words that seal the deal and announce there is no turning back. And by the end of the month, they were both starting to think long-term, permanent thoughts about the future. Then came the inevitable goodbye. And as Ferguson's love drove off for her last year of college in South Hadley, Massachusetts, he wondered how he was going to survive without her. September 8th, the summer was over and done with now. The kids were yelling under his bedroom window early in the morning again. And overnight, the Rochester air had taken on the vivid, beginning-of-the-year feel of freshly sharpened pencils and stiff new shoes, the scent of childhood, the deep-in-the-bone memories of way back when. Sad Monsieur Solitaire, who had been pining for his absent Hallie every hour over the past 10 days, returned to his rat hole at 4:30 that afternoon, and within 1 minute of his arrival, before he had managed to unload the brown paper bag with the makings of his dinner in it, the telephone rang. Pittman calling from his office at the Times Union. Pittman with a tone of urgency in his voice. Pittman telling him that something was brewing at Attica, the state prison 50 miles southwest of Rochester, and he was assigning Ferguson and Ginelli to go there early tomorrow morning to talk to Vincent Mancusi, the superintendent of the prison, to find out what was going on. The interview had already been arranged for 9 o'clock. Ginelli would be picking him up at 7, and while it was still just a little mess at this point, it could turn out to be a big one, so keep your eyes and ears open, Archie, and stay out of trouble. There had been 2 large disturbances at New York prisons in the past year, one at upstate Auburn and the other at the Tombs in Manhattan. Rugged physical confrontations between prisoners and guards that had led to scores of indictments and additional punishments. Leaders from both uprisings, most of them black, all of them committed to some form of revolutionary politics, had been transferred to Attica in order to, quote, weed out the troublemakers. And now that Black Panther George Jackson had been gunned down and killed at San Quentin Prison in California during a supposed attempt to escape with a gun stashed inside the Afro wig he was wearing. Some people actually believed that. The inmates at the overcrowded New York prisons were beginning to make noise again. 60% of the 2,250 prisoners at Attica were black. 100% of the guards were white. And not only was Ferguson not looking forward to his first visit to a maximum security correctional facility, he was dreading it. He was glad Ginelli would be going with him. The one-hour drive would be pleasant enough as Tom talked to him in the voices of Cary Grant and Jean Harlow and rattled on about the National League pennant race. But once they got there and walked into the prison, they would be stepping into hell. Ferguson didn't want it anymore. He was burned out and ready to give up. And after telling himself he was finished 6 times in the past 8 or 9 months and then not doing anything about it, this time he wasn't going to back down. He'd come to the end of what he could endure. Enough of Rochester, enough of the paper, enough of having to live with his eyes permanently fixed on the dark world of meaningless wars and lying governments and spying undercover cops and angry, hopeless men trapped in dungeons built by the state of New York. It wasn't teaching him anything anymore. Again and again he kept learning the same lesson, and by now he knew the story by heart, even before he sat down to write it. Rien ne va plus, as the gamblers in Monte Carlo were told when the wheel was about to spin again. No more bets. He had put his money on number 0 and had lost, and now it was time to get out. He would go to the prison with Ginelli in the morning. He would do the interview with the warden, who would probably tell him everything was under control, and if he asked to have a look around and perhaps talk to one or two of the prisoners, he would doubtless be turned down for security reasons. Then he would write whatever story he was able to write and hand it into Pittman. But that would be the last one. He would tell Pittman he was through and shake his hand goodbye. After that, he would go to McManus's office and thank Carl for having given him the chance to work there. shake his hand, and thank him for the privilege of having known him. But he wasn't cut out for this kind of work anymore, he would say. The job was killing him now, and he was all washed up. And then he would thank his boss again for being the good man he was, and walk out of the building for the last time. 5 o'clock. He picked up the phone and dialed Hallie's number in Massachusetts. But no one answered after 14 rings, not even Hallie's roommate, to tell him Hallie was out for the evening and wouldn't be back until 11 or 12. Hallie's blue eyes looking at him as he looked at her crawling toward him on the bed. Hallie's fierce little body pressing up against him. "Tell me some of the things you like best," she had once asked him, and he had answered her with a silly, punning joke. "The seals in Central Park, the ceiling in Grand Central Station, and the convenience of using self-sealing envelopes." "CCC," she had responded. Or perhaps she was saying C, C, C. At times she laughed so hard that her face turned red. If he wasn't going to live in Rochester anymore, where did he want to go? Massachusetts to begin with, South Hadley, Massachusetts, to talk things out with her and come up with some kind of plan. Perhaps rent an apartment somewhere in the neighborhood and work on Villon while she went to school, or else do that for a while as he decompressed and learned how to become human again, and then fly off to Paris with her over Christmas break, or else wander around Europe on his own and see as much as he could in a month or 2 months or 4 months. No, not 4 months. That would be too long. He wouldn't be able to stand it. A little apartment in Amherst or some other town. That might be a good solution for the time being. And then off to Europe together for a couple of months after she graduated in June. Anything was possible. By dipping into his grandmother's fund whenever the urge came over him, all things would be possible this year. 6 o'clock, scrambled eggs, ham, and 2 slices of buttered toast for dinner, along with 4 glasses of red wine. Lui qui buvait du meilleur et plus cher, et ne douce de la voix vaillante en pigna. 7 o'clock. He was sitting at his desk now and looking at those 2 lines from Villon's testament, roughly meaning he who drank the best and most expensive wines and didn't have enough to buy a comb, or, and couldn't afford the price of a comb, or, and didn't have the cash to buy a comb, or, and lacked the dough to spring for a comb, or, and was too broke to splurge on a comb, or, and didn't have the bread to pop for a comb. 9 o'clock. He called Massachusetts again. 20 rings this time, but again there was no answer. It wasn't just a new love, but a new kind of love, a new way of being with someone that translated into a new way of being himself, a better way because of who and what and how she was with him, the way of being himself he had always aspired to but had never managed to accomplish in the past. No more bouts of morose introspection. No more journeys into the bogs of brooding self-torment. No more turning against himself, which was a weakness that had always made him less than he should have been. "Guinness gives you strength," said the signs on the walls and bars. Hallie gave him strength. "Guinness is good for you," said the signs on the walls and bars. There was no doubt that Hallie Doyle was good for him. 11:15. Ferguson went into the bedroom, wound the clock, and set the alarm for 6 a.m. Then he returned to the living room, picked up the phone, and called Hallie again. There was no answer. In the apartment directly below Ferguson's, Charlie Vincent turned off the television, stretched his arms, and rose from the couch. The tenant upstairs was climbing into bed, the good-looking boy who had been sleeping with the pretty blonde all through the summer. Such nice, friendly kids they were, always with a pleasant word on the stairs or in front of the mailboxes. But now the girl was gone, and the boy was sleeping alone again, which was too bad in a way, since he had enjoyed listening to the bed shake upstairs and hearing the boy's grunts and the girl's yelps and moans. Such good sounds they were, so satisfying to the ear and every other part of him, always wishing he could have been upstairs in the bed with them, not as he was now, but in the old body he used to have when he was young and pretty himself. The years, how many long years ago had that been, and even if he couldn't go upstairs to be with them or watch them from a chair in a corner of their room, listening to them and imagining them had been almost as good. And now that the boy was alone, there was something good about that, too. Such a lovely boy, with his broad shoulders and sympathetic eyes. What he wouldn't give to hold that naked boy in his arms and cover his body with kisses. So Charlie Vincent turned off the television and shuffled from the living room to his bedroom in order to listen to the bed creak as the boy tossed around on the mattress and settled in for the night. It was dark in the room now. Charlie Vincent took off his clothes, lay down on the bed, and thought about the boy as he fiddled with himself until his breath grew short and the warmth spread through him and the job was done. Then, for the 53rd time since that morning, he lit one of his long, unfiltered Pall Malls and began to puff.